Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and for many years I did live radio. Then I transitioned to the podcast world where I feel I found my home. I love talking about spiritual formation, justice issues, and spiritual practices. Throw in the Enneagram, movies, and current events from time to time, and that's what you get on the podcast. I'm glad you've come along for the ride. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Welcome to Faith Conversations, everyone. You have a treat for you today because joining me is Christine Valters Paintner. There was a time when I was such a fangirl, totally, and I still love her work immensely. But I guess I've gotten over the fangirl part because we've been able to talk with her multiple times here on Faith Conversations, and I'm grateful for that. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Christine, who she is, and her work, Christine Valters Paintner is the online abbess for Abbey of the Arts, and we're going to talk about what that is in just a moment or two. She is a prolific author and poet. Her books have been on monasticism and creativity, some tremendous books. I have my own personal favorites. Maybe I'll mention those a little bit later as well. And she is a Benedictine oblate living in Galway, Ireland with her husband, John. And together they lead writing retreats and pilgrimages in Ireland, Scotland, Austria, and Germany, as well as online retreats. And we'll ask about that and find out about that too. So Christine, welcome back to Faith Conversations.
Thanks, Anita. It's lovely to be here with you.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. And we're going to focus in on a little bit on sacred time, embracing an intentional way of life. I started to say this is your newest book, but I don't think that's true, actually. I think something else has come out since this or maybe is about
to come out. It's coming out in October.
Is that what? Okay.
Breath Prayer. So this is technically the most recent release.
Latest. So I want to ask multiple questions. Number one, you are not originally from Galway, Ireland. For those that don't know, where did you hail from and how long have you been in Ireland?
I was born and raised in New York City. My father worked at the United Nations, so we lived right near there. I went to college at Fordham in New York, and then like a lot of people that age, decided I wanted to get as far away from home as possible and joined the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, which took me out to the West Coast, where I spent the next probably 20 years of my life, at first in Northern California, Bay Area, and then Seattle for almost 10 years. And then my husband and I decided to embark on a midlife pilgrimage. This was in 2012. And we were going to go just for a sabbatical, but due to all kinds of synchronicities and promptings and urgings from sources bigger than us, we ended up moving actually first to Vienna, Austria, which is where my father was from, and 6 months later to Ireland, where we've been now for about 9 years. So,
wow. 9 years. And I kind of detect that Irish accent starting to rub off on you. It's kind of hard when you're around it all the time for that not to happen. Am I hearing that right? Would you say that's true?
I would never try to put on an Irish accent. However, I'm sure that there are little sayings that, you know, ways of speaking that have worked their way into my vocabulary that I know are very distinct to Ireland or sure. Even British English as opposed to American English.
Sure. And I think it actually, if you were Irish, we might have to all focus just a little bit harder to understand you possibly. how have you found Ireland and welcoming a hard place to go? Obviously, that's where you stayed. So I'd love for you to say a word about that.
Yeah, we have found the Irish people to be incredibly warm and welcoming and hospitable, all the things they're kind of known for. We do live in a city, Galway, but it's a small city, about 80,000 people plus a student population. So in that sense, I think if maybe we lived to moved to some rural town, it might have been a little harder to assimilate. However, I just was visiting a friend of mine up in Donegal this weekend, and she's not from this, she lives very rurally, and she said the people there have been incredibly welcoming. So I think it's probably pretty pretty universal. Nice. So yeah, we love the culture here. The people are very warm and kind, and overall it's a place that, yeah, that suits us really well. And of course the richness of the monastic tradition here is so it's just at every, like within an hour of where we live, there are so many sacred sites and ruins of ancient stone monuments and so forth. So it's pretty beautiful.
Hence why you and John lead retreats, pilgrimages, etc. And so that brings me to talking about Abbey of the Arts. You're the online abbess for Abbey of the Arts. And tell folks what Abbey of the Arts is. And I will link to the website in the show notes for everyone as well.
Yeah, it's essentially a virtual monastery and a global community. So it's a monastery that doesn't have a fixed place. You know, we run it out of our apartment here in Galway, but this isn't, you know, this is part of the abbey, sort of where we live, but it's not the abbey. We don't have a space that people come to stay in. We go to B&Bs when we lead programs here. And we're a dispersed community. So we have, you know, thousands of members who are literally all over the world, US and Canada and UK and Europe and Ireland and Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Asia, and then, you know, a few other countries here and there. And that's one of the things I love most about this, is that I think particularly growing up with this kind of United Nations culture through my father, that sense of being connected to people all over the world is a really beautiful gift.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, I had forgotten that your father was with the United Nations. So that whole piece of the Abbey of the Arts really is lovely when I, you know, thinking about that, that connection. How long, I mean, did you start leading retreats and doing pilgrimages for people soon after you arrived in Ireland? Was that part of your thought and idea when you landed there?
It actually wasn't. When we moved to Europe, I thought that I would be going back to the States a couple times a year to lead retreats there. And then we had already been doing online programs at that point, so I knew we would be doing that. But then when we came to Ireland, you know, basically when people found out what we did, they're like, oh, have you seen this sacred site or this sacred site? Or have you talked to this guide or this guide? And, you know, people connected us so quickly with all of the incredible resources here. And we thought, this was in, I think it was in 2013. So it was maybe just a few months after we moved here and we started to get familiar with all of the resources. And we thought, oh, maybe we'll lead a pilgrimage next year. We'll just put it out there. And our ethos is really a small group. So only 12 people, slow paced. So you only go to one site per day. And also we stay in the same place for the entire week. So there's no moving from hotel to hotel.
Can I just say how wonderful that sounds as someone who has been to Israel on numerous occasions and thought that the pace of a trip to the Holy Land would kill me.
Yeah.
It's just exhausting. And you come to a point where, okay, I've seen one too many piles of rubble, you know, the ruins start to look the same. Yeah. And to go at a slower pace, I think could be so much more effective. And here you're telling me that's exactly what you do.
Yeah, we essentially designed the retreats in the way that we would like to participate and experience them. And I even, you know, when we first started offering them, we might have like two sites in a day, but as the longer we've led things, the fewer things we've included.
Interesting.
Because most of the people who come are, well, you know, because our focus is on contemplative practice, that most people who come are really longing for, that spaciousness and time and silence. And, you know, we'll have a guide at a site, but then we'll also have, you know, an hour in silence where you just get to explore, have some ritual together.
Nice.
So there's that sense of like really connecting. And we've had people tell us that they felt more like they felt they had more of an intimate relationship with Ireland in a trip like this than on their tour where they, you know, went, you know, for 2 weeks all around, you know, the country.
That makes sense. Yeah. Oh, I love that. And it, that is what people are longing for. Our, in our regular day-to-day lives, we can't necessarily stop and have that extended time of silence. And so it's a gift to go on a retreat and receive that and not have it as busy as our lives that we left, you know, before coming, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, exactly.
I love that. I want to say a couple of things. One, I became acquainted with your books, I think through my spiritual director. I didn't mention that you are a trained spiritual director and supervisor. You're also, I love this, you're also a registered expressive arts consultant and educator from the International Expressive Arts Therapy Association. I mention that because I believe it was my spiritual director who introduced me to I don't know if it was Earth, our original monastery, or, I think it was Water, Wind, Earth, and Fire, and the Artist Rule, actually. That's that's what it was. And so as I started reading those books, I came across an aspect of your writing that I absolutely love, which is involving your husband in your books, and also involving creativity and creative expression. And that was huge. And I've had several small groups go through what is my personal favorite book of yours, The Soul of a Pilgrim. I recommend it far and wide. And but I mean, all of your books are wonderful, but I've taken groups through The Soul of a Pilgrim. And also I have been in a small group that's gone through The Soul's Slow Ripening. But talk about why it's important. And the fact is, in Sacred Time, your latest book, you do this as well. You have your husband, John, involved with some Lectio Divina. You in different books, you've had Midrash as a practice, possible practice, poetry. But I'll just let you talk about why that is so important to you, and even what kinds of practices you do have that are involved, that you invite us to in Sacred Time.
Yeah, I suppose when I was in graduate school, I discovered this field. I was in graduate school for theology, but I discovered this field called the expressive arts. I was in the Bay Area, which is kind of where the heart of that work was being founded. And it was essentially a revelation to me, because there was all this language. I had been drawn to engaging the arts and retreat work for many years before then. And then all of a sudden I had all this language for understanding why that felt so satisfying to me and so enriching and all of that. And really it's about, there's lots of layers to it, but it's giving us multiple languages for accessing or listening to the sacred source or the divine, you know. And I certainly believe that God doesn't just speak to us through words, but also through silence and through movement and through, you know, photography or, you know, the visual beauty of nature. And so it was going through that, deepening into that work, into the expressive arts, really helped me to kind of bring that even more fully into the contemplative work I was doing, and how I really feel like it's a kind of a rhythm that goes back and forth in terms of creativity. I feel like contemplation and stillness and silence are an essential part of the creative process, much like I often think about the seasons of the year and how spring and summer is very much that blossoming, flowering, fruitfulness time, which for me very much corresponds to the act of creating and bringing things into the world and bringing that life in. And then you have the fall and the winter, which are the times of releasing, resting, moving into incubation, dream time, mystery. And that for me is the contemplative aspect. So there's this sense of like the cyclical nature of our journeys when we open up to both the contemplative and the creative. And I think they help to really enrich one another. And so in my books and my retreats, I often include different explorations, I often call them. So John will write scripture reflections because that's one of his loves. And I will do, different meditations often as a way of, I find meditation as a way of kind of crossing the threshold in our own imagination into that more, accessing that more intuitive, creative place. And then, poetry exercises. I love inviting people into writing poetry, and especially when I surprise people into realizing that they really are poets.
can I just interrupt and say you completely surprised a small group that I'm a part of it to loving poetry and deciding once we had finished one of your books and we moved on to a book of a different author that we went through, continuing that practice of using poetry to engage with the work that we were mm-hmm. reading. And I said, and you said this in your books, I said, it does not have to be exactly what Christine is doing. I said, you can use haiku, you can, whatever the case. And I think you actually probably introduced that too, but haiku stuck. And then a couple in the group moved on to other forms of poetry and have just continued. And I was shocked at what this sparked in me. And I love that you invite people into this space. I think so often we're not aware of what we need until we're invited somewhere.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think a lot of people need permission to really allow that creative, surge to flow in our lives. I think of creativity as that connection to our aliveness, like what brings us joy and delight, but also helps facilitate the times of grief and sadness and sorrow. So, the creative act is really a way of making room for what's moving through us. And then that creative act helps to transform it in some way, which is one of its great gifts.
Regular listeners to the podcast know I recently had a fall and I've been recovering from a traumatic brain injury. And I just recently pulled out a notebook and I said, I want to do some haiku about this. And I did several. I sat and, over a couple of days worked on some and came back to them, and I realized I shared them with this small group that I talked about. And one of the women made the observation that I had not seen at all, but it was a progression. I kind of wrote through a progression of what had happened. And I realized I often use specifically haiku as a way to distill down something so that I see and understand. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even realize that initially, but I just love it for that purpose.
Yeah, that's a wonderful example of how the arts can be healing and reveal new dimensions to our experience to ourselves mm-hmm. and help to integrate. And I often think about arts as a process of discovery, much like a pilgrimage, and how, when I'm writing, particularly when I'm writing poetry, I almost never know what the end of the poem is going to be. And that's part of what I love about the act of writing it, is I get to discover what it is I'm actually wanting to say or what's coming through.
But, that reminds me of a novelist talking about how they don't know where a character is going to end up. And, it's like they're writing this and it unfolds as they write it. I hadn't thought about that in terms of poetry. So that's fascinating to hear you say that. Mm-hmm. Tell about your Well, actually, I want you to tell about your poetry books. A couple of things. One, people may not know, if they've read some of your work, sometimes you'll end a chapter with a poem. Not always, but you are a poet. You have written some poetry books. You're an award-winning poet. Where did that love come from? Is this long-lived in you or more recent? I'd like to know.
Yeah, I've loved writing since I was very young. That love has been there, yeah, since I can really first remember, probably around 7 or 8 years old. And I even went to graduate school and got a PhD thinking that it would make me a better writer, that was part of the motivation for going. And it, while it certainly gave me certain gifts and tools and skills, it also trained me to be a particular kind of writer. And then when I finished the PhD and realized I didn't actually want to be an academic, I had to untrain myself. And what happened was, that's actually when I started writing a blog that became Abbey of the Arts later on. And the blog was actually brilliant, for really helpful for trying to write shorter and more accessible to people. Nice. And it really was in moving to Ireland where I kind of found a community of, you know, so many people in Ireland are artists. Like, that is cultivated as just a part of who you are. And, ooh, you know, people play a musical instrument, or they write, or, you know, and it doesn't, in the States, sometimes if you say, you know, I'm a poet, people will kind of scoff and be like, well, what do you really do? You know, but
right. Yeah. What's your day job?
Right? Yeah, exactly. And here you might have a day job too, but there's a more honoring of, yeah, that this is actually part of people's joy. So anyway, in Galway, there's a great literary community. There's a lot of wonderful arts things happening in Galway, which is part of what we love about it here.
Nice.
And that was kind of what gave me, I'd been loving poetry and using it in retreats for years, but it's sort of what gave me the confidence and the encouragement to start refining and crafting my poems in a particular way. And yeah, looking to share them in that way.
So you have at least one, I think two books of poetry, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Can you give us the names of those?
Yeah, the first one is called Dreaming of Stones and is very much inspired by living in Ireland. And the second one is called The Wisdom of Wild Grace. And there's a series of 30 poems in there that are inspired by these saint and animal stories that I love so much. They're all these wonderful stories about the kinship between various saints and certain creatures. And I just love these stories for their sense of intimacy with the wild world and how that was a sign of holiness. Mm. I think there's something marvelous about that.
Nice. Well, I thought that it might be nice during our time together to have you read one of your poems, maybe one of your favorites. Now, I don't know if picking a favorite is possible. You know, you ask someone about their kids, they can't pick a favorite child. So I don't know if you've picked something that's a favorite of yours or felt right about the day, you'll have to tell us.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to pick a favorite, but I'm going to read this poem. It's called Saint Hildegard Gives Her Writing Advice, since we're talking a lot about writing and poetry. And Hildegard of Bingen, of course, is the 12th century medieval Benedictine abbess who was, you know, a herbalist and a preacher and a theologian and a musician. And I absolutely love her and find great inspiration. So this poem is sort of an imagining that she is giving me some writing advice.
Nice.
Cry out and write were the words you heard tumble toward you from the blue spattered sky midway through your life. Follow the greening you tell me in dreams, and I reach for the thread which slips from my close clutched hand on fine days. How, I plead, can you show me my dog playing in the sunlight, the way shadows sashay across my desk and the orchid holds out her purple tongue. always make time for tea, you utter, as you take me by the hand through the garden, show me dandelion and thistle, yarrow and sage. Sipping slows you down so you can see. Listen to the flowers teach, you whisper, find a meadow, lie down, and wait for the poem to arrive. I scoff and sigh, then find myself among marigold, long grasses, and loosestrife, all singing their glee, and my page is full before I remember how I resisted coming here at all.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I love that. And I just feel like reading your books causes me to slow down. I just like that poem. That is beautiful. And that is maybe a good bridge into talking about sacred time, embracing an intentional way of life. Talk about, you know, what the impetus behind sacred time was. I know different writers arrive at books in different ways. I'm kind of curious how this one came to be.
Yeah, this book has been sort of incubating and germinating for many years, actually. I actually taught a course on this material several years ago that was sort of the early version. And it was inspired initially by my own Benedictine commitment as a, you know, monastic person living in the world. And the praying, the liturgy of the hours, you know, praying throughout the rhythm of the day. There's a wonderful book called The Music of Silence by Brother David Steindl-Rast. He's a Benedictine monk. Mm-hmm. And it's one of my favorite books ever because that book helped break open for me the praying of the hours and to see it as this real, a series of poetic invitations throughout the day that in each unfolding moment that dawn invites us to a particular awareness of that new awakening and the, you know, the freshness of the day and the midday point, you know, invites us to consider the fullness of things and the, you know, the height of passion and heat and all of that. And evening invites us to that release and letting go. And I think that combined with my own deepening love of the seasons and their own wisdom that they offer. And then kind of what brought it all together for me was actually being in a yoga class where we practiced a breath practice called Samavriti, which is equal parts breathing. And so basically you do an inhale, you hold the breath, you exhale, you hold the breath, all for equal parts. And it suddenly occurred to me that all those four moments corresponded to the seasons of the year. So the inhale is like the springtime, the fullness is like the summer, the exhale of release is the autumn, the emptiness at the bottom is like winter. And then of course, that also corresponds to the movement of the hours of the day, to the lunar cycles. And so the more I contemplated this, the more I saw that rhythm of rise and fall, fullness and emptiness at the heart of everything, like from the breath to the day, to the week, to the month, to the year, even then to our seasons of a lifetime. And I also write about ancestral time and cosmic time. And even in cosmic time, you know, scientists envision the universe as like this great kind of in-breath or expansion, and eventually at some point there'll be that contraction again. So even on this kind of cosmic scale. So that was sort of the heart of being a monk in the world is tending to the moments of the day and finding ways that help remind me to bring my full attention to what this moment invites me to and calls me to.
And even as I hear you say that, one of the things I can picture somebody asking this, someone listening and going, you know, that sounds all well and good, but I get up and I go to a 9-to-5 and I, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Well, you as well are productive. You wouldn't have however many, 15 books or however many under your belt without paying attention to and having some sort of a working rhythm, but sometimes we're just not, I don't know what you would call it, maybe not aware, or we don't pay attention or choose to pay attention or have a specific rhythm. We just do and then we drop. We don't, you know. Mm-hmm. So talk about the rhythms of the day. I know this is something you write about. Specifically, it's one of the chapters in Sacred Time, but talk about rhythms of the day, and because you have to have them no matter what. You're not coming to this conversation here as someone who just sits in silence all day long and does nothing.
That would be lovely. But yeah, I mean, I suppose for myself, I find I'm someone who really thrives on kind of more organic time and not being overly scheduled. So I think part of it, what I recommend to people is to grow more intimate with your own rhythms and, you know, what times of the day do you thrive and what times of day do you need more restfulness and sort of downtime or less product, you know, kind of quote unquote productivity. What are the moments when you can pause for, you know, three breaths and just, you know, even talk about the transitions. Like if you're in meetings all day long, could you take 1 minute between each meeting and simply breathe and just hold that awareness of that little space or that little portal between tasks? And might that then open up kind of a deeper awareness? You know, might you then move into the next thing with a little bit more centeredness and presence? So even in the book, I talk about, you know, just a simple practice of setting an alarm like 4 times during the day to become aware of that morning, midday, evening, and night, and the invitations that they might offer to you. And so it's something that doesn't have to take very long, but I do think it can then infuse the way we move through the day with that kind of awareness or sacred seeing. I'd say the other practice for me that feels really essential is Sabbath keeping. And it's one that I struggle with a lot. So it's not to say that I think it's an easy practice at all. And I don't even think that people need to necessarily find a whole day for the Sabbath. If that, you know, lots of reasons, people are caretakers of children or elderly parents, as well as working, and maybe you work more than one job and it's just not possible. But I do think it's possible to find, you know, an hour of Sabbath or, you know, an afternoon of Sabbath during the week when you, I think, really step into this. I love the monastic teaching around humility, this sense of that the world doesn't, I don't have to carry the world on my shoulders. And can I step into this little window of time and simply let go of all the responsibilities that I'm holding and believe that the world won't come crashing down? And that's the hard thing for, I think, for a lot of people, particularly if you're in a caretaking kind of role. And how incredibly renewing and refreshing that is, and how necessary that is to really resist, because we live in such a culture of doing and productivity and pressure and valuing ourselves according to what we do. And think just for me, the role of the contemplative is to really resist that.
Well, and I think a piece of that too, what two thoughts that came to my mind. I loved that you mentioned tea in the poem. Mm-hmm. Big tea drinker, and it takes time to steep the tea. My husband doesn't love being with me out somewhere if I decide to get tea, because I have little stuff I carry with me in my purse, and anyway, he did. Mm-hmm. But I also thought of the subtitle of your book, Sacred Time: Embracing an Intentional Way of Life. And I think it's easy to go through life mindlessly and not intentionally. And mm-hmm. so I think that's one of the things that you're talking about and drawing us toward. When we embrace an intentional way of life, it doesn't necessarily look like the person next door to us, but it is specific to ourselves and extremely important to be intentional about it, is what I'm taking, is part of what I'm taking away from Sacred Time.
Yeah, I write about in the introduction, you know, that there are these two kinds of time. One is the chronos time, which is the time of the clicking, the the ticking of the clock. I don't know why I had trouble saying that, the ticking clock, not the clicking talk. the ticking clock, the schedules, the day planners and all of that. And then there's Kairos time, which is the time of the inbreaking of the divine, of the holy. And, there are ways we can make ourselves available to that. And so our problem isn't that we need more hours in the day, because that would not solve our issue. We would just find more things to do. Our issue really is to, how do we make ourselves more available to the inbreaking of those eternal moments? When all of a sudden, for a few minutes, we feel the spaciousness of time, or those moments when you've been in a conversation with a friend and you think, oh, I wish this moment could go on forever. You know, sometimes we have that awareness kind of enter in. We can't, of course, function our lives always in the eternal moment, but we can cultivate practices that make us more available to recognize that when that's happening, and to savor that experience, which is always a renewing, refreshing moment in our day.
I like that. I really appreciate that. When you write your books, do you think about individuals that will read them, or do you think about them in that group context?
That's a good question. A lot of the books I wrote drafts of while teaching an online course. So
okay, sure.
A lot of times I'll have that particular community gathered nice. In my mind. And sometimes there are certain people who are, you know, more vocal about things yeah. and they might be in my mind, but yeah, sort of definitely that community of contemplatives.
Yes. Well, I love that. Because I realized, confession here, when I would read through your books alone, I would sometimes skip over practices that mm-hmm. I knew would really benefit me, but in a group context, I wouldn't, because we would each bring the practices that we engaged in, and it was such a rich experience. So I'm just a big proponent of that small group experience, going through a book together. And so I was mm-hmm. curious, that makes sense that, you know, you're writing some of this even while using material with groups, retreat groups, etc. What's your hope for people that read Sacred Time? What would you like them to walk away with?
I suppose a real invitation to cultivate moments of more spaciousness and to let go a bit of that relentless pressure that we both experience externally, as well as the internal voice that, you know, we've kind of been co-opted by the capitalist system. And, you know, how do we, I think for me, a contemplative way of life is a way of life that witnesses to another way of being in the world. And so that for me is, all the practices are about giving us little portals into that and discovering, oh, there's like an immense depth beneath the surface of things, of whatever we're doing in the most ordinary of moments. And so how does that break open for us?
I love that. I cannot recommend highly enough any of Christine Walter's Paintner's books. Today, we just happen to be talking about Sacred Time, Embracing an Intentional Way of Life, because it's her latest book that's out. But I will put links to this latest book and to some others as well in the show notes, along with ways to connect with Christine, because I recommend that you go to Abbey of the Arts and sign up for her weekly email. I know I get it on Sundays, I think, every week, and enjoy reading that. And it fills you in on more information if you want to take part in other retreats, or in big and small ways, you know, maybe even traveling, who knows. But I'm going to put all of those links in the show notes. Christine, it's always a treat to be with you. I feel like I just slow down in your presence. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Anita.
And to everyone else, as always, I just say, keep the conversation going.